For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. Republicans are doing some damage control this week after Mother Jones magazine published a covert video of Mitt Romney's comments to wealthy donors that a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was unrealistic. The video, which was published online on the magazine's website, provoked hand-wringing that Romney's remarks could compromise U.S. standing as an honest broker in the peace process should Romney become president. But Romney isn't alone in his doubts about the viability of a two-state solution. A growing number of activists, scholars, and commentators, Palestinian and Israeli, have been declaring that the two-state solution has been dead for some time now, based on physical and political realities on the ground in the occupied West Bank. The failure of the Oslo Accords to lead to a negotiated two-state settlement has led to calls for something else. A one-state solution where Palestinians and Jews would live together in full civil and political equality. George Bisharat is a law professor at University of California's Hastings College of the Law and a former trial lawyer for the Office of the Public Defender in San Francisco. Professor Bisharat studied law, anthropology, and Middle East studies at Harvard and is the author of a book about Palestinian lawyers working under Israeli military occupation in the West Bank. He writes frequently on law and politics in the Middle East. Professor George Bisharat, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
Thank you for joining us. I'd like to start, just maybe start off a little bit with Romney's comments, doubting that a future Palestinian state was possible and characterizing Palestinians as uninterested in peace and interested only in the destruction of Israel. A few critics have pointed out that aside from the kind of craven obeisance to the talking points of the current Israeli government, Romney merely stated what U.S. policy towards Palestine actually is instead of the policy that gets lip service. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I think the comments were misguided and unhelpful, but there are elements of his analysis that I agree with, and certainly I agree that the viability of a two-state solution is in question, if not clearly extinguished. And I think it's healthy that there begins to be debate now about what happens. I think people are finally beginning, people in responsible, positions are beginning to think about what's next. If we really have failed to bring the two-state solution to fruition, what are we going to do about it now?
And could you tell us what's happened on the ground since the Oslo Accords of 1993 in terms of the viability of a future Palestinian state side by side, the typical rendition for some years now, and at least in words by the position of both the U.S. government and the Israeli government? What's happened on the ground and what does it mean for this vision of the future?
Sure. Well, the most important developments are the vast expansion of Israeli, Jewish-Israeli colonization of the West Bank. The numbers of Israeli settlers who live in the occupied territories has approximately tripled from about 200,000 at the beginning of the Oslo process to now about 600,000. And there is, of course, also the construction of the separation wall, or the apartheid wall, as many call it, through vast parts of the West Bank, which has resulted in the seizures of ever more Palestinian property, and the enclosures of Palestinian towns and villages, severe restrictions on freedom of movement within the occupied territories, the rendering of the West Bank economy into a dependent aid-based economy, and a variety of other measures that have only cemented and entrenched Israeli control over the geography and over the lives of the Palestinian people of the occupied territories.
What do you mean by when you say the enclosure of Palestinian villages? Can you talk about the physical infrastructure that's accompanied this settlement activity, roads, appropriation of water, that kind of thing?
Sure, sure. I mean, there are. It consists of road systems on which only Israelis, which means primarily Israeli Jews, can travel. It consists of security areas. It consists of military closed areas. And it consists of, electrical plants and all kinds of services that serve the Israeli settlements, which basically bar Palestinians from traveling and having access to other towns and villages and having access to, to their families, to their doctors, to their schools, and of course to commerce. And the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have both identify the restrictions on movement as the principal reason for the very high unemployment rates in the occupied territories, which at times the figures vary, but at times the figures have reached as high as 40% unemployment.
And there's also, I guess, the continuing. Well, we can get to that point in a second. I was going to ask about the expulsions and of Palestinians, sure, from their homes, but of that's course also relevant for their inability to build, for example, within Israel. Here we're
right
talking about Palestinians in Israel, but
right.
I we can get to that in a second. But I'd like to know. So the proponents of a one-state solution. Well, first, tell us what a one-state solution would look like in terms of protections for minorities. Is something like the U.S. Constitution envisioned in that respect? How would this, what's the vision?
Yeah, I mean, there are two principal visions, one of which is often called the binational version, and the other is the secular democratic version. A binational version would be one in which Jews and Arabs have recognized collective rights under a single federal government. So Jews and Arabs would be represented. They might have, for example, equal representation in parliament. A secular democratic version means simply one person, one vote, and with no recognized status for any particular group. I personally support the latter version, because I think that the binational version would entrench identities, would exacerbate or at least continue rivalry between the two groups, and I don't think that the binational version really reflects the complexities of identity in modern day Israel-Palestine. Among Palestinians, there are divisions that are regional, that are local, that are sectarian, that are that are other, and among Israeli Jews as well, there are many differences in national origin, in cultural practice, in religious belief, and there's no reason that any one aspect of identity deserves to be institutionalized and elevated above any of these other aspects of identity. And I think there is something significant that has been lost in the reduction of both sides to either simply, Jewish Israeli or Palestinian Arab.
Well, you make an interesting point about identity. I'd like to point to a recent article in Haaretz, actually responding to an article of yours. You wrote a column supporting the one-state solution in the Huffington Post back in April, and someone responded, mm-hmm, Uriel F. Stein. I'm sure you saw this piece. But it's interesting what he says. He raises, which is, of course, going to be the first objection, which is if both populations lived in one state, the state would lose its unique Jewish character. And this fellow makes an interesting argument because he stands for this idea of, he says, that this idea represents a denial of the very purpose for Israel's creation, as well as a misunderstanding, he says, of the philosophy behind national movements. He goes on to say that by attempting to unite two entirely disparate national movements, it would deny self-determination to each of them. What's so interesting to me is that this idea that a state would, a government, a country, we're using the political the legal term almost to call it a state, a country. This reflects, it seems to me, 19th century thinking that each group that shared an identity, a single language, etc., should have their own state, whereas many states, of course, many modern states are multi-ethnic with populations of different histories. The U.S. comes to mind, for example.
Yeah, certainly.
So,
of course.
So, but that would be the second objection, of course, always made is that it's utopian. Who's going to agree to this, particularly not Israel? What's your response?
Well, I think it's I don't think it's in the offing in the next 5 years. I think there is a lot of work that has to be done to prepare both peoples to accept the idea of living on equal terms. But I actually think it is not only not utopian. I think it's inevitable. These people are not, they are destined to live together. They are not going to be separated. There is no way to separate them short of genocide or ethnic cleansing. And we have seen ethnic cleansing to a considerable extent, and I think we see it continuing in a kind of an administrative low-level form even today.
Explain that.
But well, so I assume you're asking about the administrative low-level ethnic cleansing?
I am.
To explain, yeah. So that primarily refers to the processes by which mainly around Jerusalem, Palestinian Arabs are being forced out of their homes, denied the capacity to build, in a way appropriate to their growing families and populations, and are areas of the city are being made green areas so that they can't build, Palestinians can't build in them, and essentially life is made difficult to impossible if they leave for any extended period of time. They lose their residency rights in the city of Jerusalem, and they can't return. And this is a process that has been going on for decades and has been well documented by Israeli human rights groups. It is clearly and avowedly from the Israeli side a plan to Judaize as to the greatest extent possible the city of Jerusalem and make impossible any exercise of Palestinian sovereignty there. It goes on in other parts of the country as well, even within Israel itself, but most acutely it's going on in the vicinity of Jerusalem.
You made an interesting point saying that in some ways, you say, Palestinians and Israelis are already living together. The argument has been made that the two populations effectively already live in one state, one being
That's
under
right.
military occupation. And the late Jewish and British historian Tony Judd wrote that Israel had three choices. This point that it just depends on what kind of state you want, because either you have a democracy with equal rights for everyone, or you have the current situation, which is a government, the Israeli government, an occupied population that's completely disenfranchised of its rights.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. I functionally, we have had a de facto single state reality since 1967, when essentially all of former Mandate Palestine came under Israeli rule. We have gradations of rights within that territory, with only Israeli Jews living within Israel and in the occupied territories exercising full rights. Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel have a kind of a diminished form of citizenship, and then people who live in the occupied territories have essentially no political rights. And then, of course, there are those who have been utterly and totally excluded from the polity, which are Palestinian refugees, those who live outside of the boundaries of former Mandate Palestine. So, the people have been living together in one functional sovereignty, under one functional sovereignty, that's the Israeli government. And the question is that status going to continue, or are we going to transform the principles on which people are living together into more just and equal ones? And to me, that's a no-brainer. Justice and equality are really the fundamentals of peaceful coexistence. When you take away people's gripes by treating them fairly and by treating them equally, you take away their incentive to struggle and fight. And it's just, to me, completely obvious that that's the direction in which we have to move.
Well, there are some folks who like to reduce the conflict to a religious conflict, as we know, and speak of the hundreds and hundreds of years. But of course, this conflict, I guess I should let you respond to that, if you'd like to.
Well, you know,
I wasn't taking it seriously as a question.
You know, I've the first time I traveled to the occupied territories was in, I think, 1977 or 78, and the rise of religiosity and religious nationalism on both sides is a worrisome development, and it's something that has, I mean, when I went there first 30 years ago, things were very, very different than they are today. And I see those developments, however, as a product of the conflict itself. I think those forms of extremism can be diminished only when the core issues are finally addressed and resolved. And I realize they are very scary to people, but they have to be treated as symptoms of a more, symptoms of an underlying ill. And that ill are the unaddressed injustices that have been afflicting the region for the last, 60 plus years.
A number of people, yourself included, a number of people, well, there were Palestinians, there were Israelis, a bunch of academics and scholars published something called a declaration of the one state. It's a declaration of basic principles. What I noticed is that most of them live outside the region. What's mm-hmm. the extent of political support for an alternative one-state solution from people in the region? And I would include the political leadership of Palestinians.
Well, it's hard to say. There's polling evidence within the occupied territories that suggests that support for one state varies between 25% and 33%. Which is significant in that there's no political party that actually espouses a one-state solution at this particular point in time, and that's a lot of support considering that lack of open political leadership. I think the Palestinian officialdom, unfortunately, has become a kind of an obstacle to the development of further support for one state, and I think that one of the items on the agenda for people who believe in the one state solution and in a resolution based on justice and equality is to reform essentially and reinvigorate and replace, to be quite honest, the current Palestinian leadership. But it should be noted as well that the occupied territories are the areas in which you might expect the least amount of support for the one-state solution and the greatest amount of support for a two-state solution, because a two-state solution would ostensibly address the concerns. I mean, if an independent Palestinian state were created in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, perhaps, that would alleviate a lot of the immediate pain that is suffered by people in those areas. It would fail to address the conditions of the Palestinian citizens of Israel, and it would be a very inadequate response to the right of Palestinian refugees to return, those who are living outside.
Or less support for a one-state solution in the Palestinian territories? And actually, we have to end here, so it needs to be a short answer.
Sure. Okay. Well, I think support among Palestinians outside of the occupied territories is greater than within the occupied territories, but I think it is growing throughout the Palestinian community, and soon it will have to be reflected in official Palestinian policy.
I'd like to point out also that in Israel, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, an organization, came out with a report recommending a one-state solution and describing it. That report was released on September 13th. So this is an Israeli organization supporting a one-state solution.
Right.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with George Bisharat, a law professor at University of California's Hastings College of the Law. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.